Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and in light of Irish President Hagan's landmark visit to the UK, and indeed the why don't we link with Professor Sarah Foote? And she is the chairman of the board of faculty of theology and religion at the University of Oxford. And Professor Sarah, you are indeed very welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Adrian. I'm delighted to talk to you today.
Now, tell me, now, you're the Regius Professor of Ecclesiastical History and
That's right.
And a canon of Christ Church Cathedral. And tell us a little bit about that job. Because first of all, congratulations, because you have been appointed by the Queen to that position. So
that's right. So these are professorships that were originally created by Queen Victoria. And designed to have high-level academics who could specialise in areas that were useful for the training of Anglican clergy. But now our roles are to train students who are destined for all sorts of professions, not just those who want to be vicars, but those who are going to go out and serve a multicultural, multiracial global economy.
Uh-huh.
So my role is to teach about the history of the church in that context, and my speciality is the history of the church in Western Europe in the first millennium.
Yes.
And I work especially on the church in the British Isles. And so one of the big areas of interest for me is the contribution that was made by the Irish church and the Celtic church more generally to the development of religion in the medieval West.
Okay, now a little bit of about Oxford University. And its significance, we know that, of course, when you just mention Oxford, we are we're talking also about an institution which lies 60 miles or so northwest of London. And how did it become the world famous educational center? Maybe you can fill us in on that, Professor.
Well, precisely when the University of Oxford was established remains slightly unclear. It's often said that Oxford wasn't founded, it just emerged as a community of scholars in the 12th century. But the exciting thing about teaching in theology is that theology was the very first subject taught in Oxford. And we know that there were monks and priests and scholars teaching at a high level in Oxford in the 12th century, and that they were teaching about the Bible and Christian doctrine and moral teaching, and they collected a variety of students around them and very rapidly became a major international center that people traveled to. So the great scholar Gerald of Wales, when he'd done his itinerary of Ireland and he wrote, he finished his text looking at the topography of Ireland, he was looking for somewhere where he could find an audience where he could read his new book to, and he chose to go to Oxford, and for 3 days he read about the history and topography of Ireland to all these Oxford students. So the connection between the University of Oxford and Ireland goes all the way back to the beginnings of the university.
Mm. Now, explain to us, if you will, the ecclesiastical history.
Yes.
Ecclesiastical history has little to do with the division historically for both Ireland and Great Britain. It has very little to do with Catholics or Protestants, but it does have a lot to do with Christianity.
It does. It It's about, I mean, ecclesiastical history is the history of the churches, plural, across mm-hmm. the globe in the two millennia of Christian history. And my predecessors have worked on different periods of Christian history. So Jack McManus, who held the chair in the 1980s and 1990s, was a great historian of the French Enlightenment. My immediate predecessor, Henry Marr Harting, was another medieval scholar who worked on Catholic Christianity in the High Middle Ages, and especially with an interest in material culture and manuscript culture of the churches. Church history, ecclesiastical history is all periods, all Christians, all places. But it just happens that my focus is on the medieval world.
Now, in ecclesiastical studies, has the makeup of Christian religions as we know them today, have they managed to morph either from Christianity into areas of conflict, into areas what created the huge number of religions? Some of them I'm sure you could fill in many that we know nothing about, but what brought about the parochialism, the divisions? Why did in Christianity did many groups go off in their own tangent, as it were?
Well, I think religions across the globe express themselves out of particular cultural and social contexts in which they find themselves. And so the big split between Protestantism and Catholicism in the 16th century is driven by a whole series of factors, some of which are to do with belief and understanding and how you read the Bible, and a lot of them are to do with contemporary politics, culture, economic affairs, and so different peoples in different parts of Europe choose to promote a particular version of reading the Bible and thinking about God, which fits well in their individual contexts.
Yeah.
So some people argue that all religions fundamentally talk about the same essential truths: who are human beings, where do they come from, what kind of divine action helps to control our lives, but we express those beliefs in different ways according to the particular social and cultural context in which we find ourselves.
Now, let me ask you about Christianity versus all other religions. What is the common theme of in Christianity, other than obviously it is the recognition of Christ, maybe the canon of Christ? Can you?
So it's the recognition of Christ as the Messiah foretold in the Jewish scriptures, that as St. John's Gospel said, that God so loved the world that he chose to send his only son to come and save humanity. And the thing that Christianity promises to believers is that there's meaning to life beyond our earthly existence,
mm-hmm.
that it offers us a hope of eternal life after our mortal life is over. And that's something that, for the medieval peoples that I work on, that's something that was fantastically appealing to them. So there's this wonderful story that the Venerable Bede tells about when the people in Northumbria were hearing the Christian message for the first time and thinking about what it meant. And there was a nobleman at the king's court, and he said, "It's Christianity tells us something about what it is to exist. It's as if you imagine you're in the hall of your lord, and it's winter, and outside the storms are raging, and inside the hall it's warm and dry and friendly and light. And into the hall there flies a sparrow, and just briefly he flies into the hall through that warmth and light and friendship, and then he flies out again into the darkness. Human existence is like the flight of that sparrow. Everything before we are is dark and bleak and snow, and we know nothing about it. And we know nothing about what will happen after we leave the light of the human world. and we're in the darkness again, but Christianity offers us a hope of immortal life. It explains something that we're not looking at a vacuum around us. It offers us this hope of eternal life beyond our earthly existence.
Now, my guest, friends, is Professor Sarah Foote, Chair of the Board of the Faculty of Theology and Religion at the University of Oxford. You have been recently commissioned by Princeton University Press to write the first major intellectual biography of Bede.
That's correct.
Addressing, well, his theological as well as his historical writings in the context of his own age, meaning...
Meaning the 8th century. He lived he was born in the 7th century. He was born about 670, and Bede died in the year 735. So it's to try and explain the totality of Bede's writings, which are very voluminous, in the context of that early 8th century European world.
Yeah. So now when you're studying theology going back to then, that obviously long before Christ or Christianity, or what's the study? What is that period? What was it called? What was religion called?
This is a Christian period. So Bede lived in the generations after Christianity had first come to the British Isles, and Bede's most famous writing is an ecclesiastical history of the English people, where he tells the story about how the different Anglo-Saxon peoples were introduced to the truths of the Christian gospel and became a people united by their belief in the Christian God. And he tells that story in which the role of the Irish play an absolutely fundamental role. The Irish are the real heroes of Bede's history, because he talks about how monks came to his own kingdom of Northumbria from the Scottish monastery of Iona, but they were monks who came originally from Ireland, monks who followed St. Columba, and it's the influence of men like Aidan and Aidan's pupil Cuthbert who really transformed the English language and the English landscape and brought Christianity to the north of England and then spread it there over the whole of the rest of England.
Now, as we understand missionaries, and particularly, only because I'm from Ireland, but the role of missionaries in going throughout the world, primarily to teach Christianity to people who had no organized religion whatsoever, was that peculiar to Ireland, or could you say that missionaries as we know them actually came from the British Isles, from the UK, from the birth of the missionary is, as I say, we are inclined to be parochial and think that it all came from Ireland. Maybe you can fill us in on that.
Well, I think it's very important to understand just how really significant Irish Christianity was in the spread of the Christian faith among the Germanic pagan peoples of Northern Europe. If it hadn't been for missionaries from Ireland going to Scotland and England, but also to France and Italy, then the Western Church wouldn't have developed in the way it did. And the Irish idea that one would leave one's homeland, one's language, one's kin, and go abroad as a pilgrim for the sake of the promotion of the faith, knowing that you'd never be able to go home to your family again, that's a massive contribution that Ireland gave to the rest of the world, and something that all of us in Western Europe should be grateful for. But yeah. Then that lesson that the Irish taught the English and the French about how it was to be a missionary, that's then an idea. So the English are converted by Irish missionaries, but they then go themselves to Germany and to Scandinavia to convert populations there. So it's an idea that the English pick up from the Irish, but then spread themselves as well. So mission is something that's then true to all Christian peoples across time. So if you look at the expansion of of Western Europe in the 15th and 16th century. It's missionaries from France and Italy,
right,
and Spain going to the New World. But the role of the Irish in first taking that idea is a really important one. And so it's not a parochial viewpoint. It's something you should be proud of.
Professor, monks, the role of monks, monasteries, again, versus the missionary who went out. Tell us about monks, monasteries, the cloisters, the perhaps the differences. Again, we have a tendency to think that monks were, that they were all Catholic, and that somehow, you know, that women belonged in convents. I must say I'm playing somewhat of the role of devil's advocate here, but there is kind of an insular degree of, in Catholicism, that says, you know, we are it. We are the chosen. We, in fact, have, you know, somehow we have the inner circle, as it were. Go back in history and tell us, has there always been kind of, well, first of all, I asked you about monks and convents, cloisters, as we know them. What's the history there?
So the idea of the monastic life, of going and living alone, away from the rest of civilization, it begins in the Egyptian desert and spreads from there to Western Europe through cross-Mediterranean routes and through France, and spreads to Britain and to Ireland. The first missionaries who came to Ireland, who came to England from Ireland, were monks, but in a tradition that saw their devotion as expressed not inside the walls of their cloisters, but by travelling as missionaries to take the faith to other people. But then that sets up, so there's a difference between the Celtic idea of monasticism, which is outward-looking and devoted to mission, and what one might call a Roman view of monasticism, where you do indeed talk about cloisters with walls that separate you from the outside world, and where you spend your time on contemplation and devotion.
And,
but there's a paradox that monasticism and mission are very closely linked in the medieval church, and in whatever tradition you come from, this sense that spreading the gospel is actually more important than looking after one's own soul. So monasticism is a really important part of the spread of the Catholic Church across the West in the first millennium.
You know, tell us about Oxford and the only chair of Celtic in England. What is that actually, Oxford having the only chair? What is the significance of that? First of all, what is the foundation? Where and when did that come about?
The chair of Celtic at the University of Oxford is the only chair of Celtic in England. There are chairs of Celtic in Ireland, as you know, and in Wales and in Scotland. But in England, the only one is at the University of Oxford. And it was established earlier than any other chair of Celtic anywhere in the world. It was created in the year 1877 to be a role for a professor who would think specifically about Irish, Welsh, Scots, Breton language, literature and culture. And I think it's really significant that that post is established in Oxford, as you said, just 60, 70 miles west of London, but absolutely at the heart of England. The chair of Celtic in Oxford is a role that can have an ambassadorial function for the promotion of Celtic studies among the English. So for saying at the heart of the English establishment what it is that Celtic has done for the shaping of England and for the making of the British Isles. And at this week of all weeks, when we've got this historic visit, that the very first time that the President of Ireland has come and paid a state visit to England and being received by the Queen, the idea that there would be a professor in Oxford of Celtic who could talk about our shared history with its separate paths, but its common, the common roots that we share, and also build on that vision that Michael Higgins spoke of when he spoke in the British Parliament, when he spoke about the importance of our moving beyond our past to talk about the powerful ways in which we can build mutual understanding and speak towards our shared common futures.
Now, there is obviously, there is a lot of generations of old sores, particularly between England and Scotland, Wales, Ireland, which some might think were actually contributed to because of religion, because of Christianity. Is that a popular, relatively speaking, a modern concept, or is it one of those throwaway lines that somebody say, "Well, listen, church religion has created more conflict than any other aspect of life and history and religion." Is that something that?
Well, certainly that's an argument one can make, but I think we can't deny the pain that's been caused in the past. We need to face up to the ways in which we, the English, behaved badly when we were colonialists, and we need to accept that there were ways in which we might have used religion unhelpfully. But I think if we're going to move forward in the kind of context that we find ourselves in the 21st century, we need to respect and recognize the pain of the past, but we need in many ways to set it behind us so that we can focus on the possibilities of the future. To get obsessed with religious separatism is not going to be a constructive way to help us forward.
Yes.
I mean, the Queen welcomed the Irish president. The Queen is the head of the Anglican Church. She is the defender of the faith in England, but she's welcoming the president of Ireland as a fellow Christian, not with any sectarian views in mind.
And with, we can equally say that the welcome for the Queen in Ireland was probably one of the most significant events that has taken place in Anglo-Irish relationships for hundreds of years.
No, I think so, and I think we need to acknowledge that it's Her Majesty herself who is to be congratulated for making that visit such a success. She's a remarkable woman, and the dignity with which she handled herself and the respect that she paid, for example, to when she went to the memorial of those who fell in the World Wars. She's a truly remarkable woman, and I think it's about her as a person that helped to make that visit such a wonderful success. And also, of course, the fantastic welcome that the people of Dublin and Ireland were able to give her.
Yes, which is obviously being reciprocated. And, as we look at it, how and is it a common belief that for progress to take place, that you have to somehow separate church and state? Sounds good, but to me anyway, it sounds like that really can't happen. And that it almost seems like you're setting up yet another division within, society, if you say, look, religion has no role to play in political reality.
No, I think we have to accept the fact that religion is a major part of this dialogue. It always has been. It will continue to be so. But to focus simply on the religious issues that divide us is a way of, I think, preventing us from moving forward. One of the things that I think that the Oxford Professorship of Celtic can do is to help to talk about the ways in which the Celtic and English worlds have interacted beyond the spheres of religion, so that we're talking about language and literature, material culture, manuscripts, stone sculpture, about the roles that Irish, Scots and Welsh people have played in the development of the English state, the part they played in parliamentary and governmental affairs. There's a wide range of spheres in which you can look beyond the religious, so not forgetting that there are religious issues there, but just making them not the only thing you talk about.
Can it be said, though, that Christianity in general has managed and in fact has a recognition that it is the one truly religious body that in fact we have this tendency to feel that if you're a Christian, it's us versus the rest of religion throughout the world.
Well, in the context of the global political context in which we find ourselves, that's not the most helpful way to advance discussion, is it? Mutual recognition of the validity of other faiths is a valuable way to proceed. So one of the things that our present Queen has done is to make a point of opening dialogue with the leaders of other major religious traditions and welcoming them too, in recognition of the fact that the British Isles is now a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious nation. That Christianity is an important part of the roots of Britain, but it's not the only faith that's articulated on the streets of London today.
Right. And of course, that would, as we look at even further into the European Union, and we have yet that new pressure to recognize and to respect other religions. What about the conflict and those who look at some religions today who obviously do not share any of the priorities, say, of Christianity, and again, looking at the perhaps we have seen some of it more so in the last decade or a couple of decades, reason for recognition that not all religions are dedicated to the fellowship and the interpretation, either of the Bible or the Quran or whatever, that there is something that we can't say all religions, are positive in our eyes.
No, I think that's true, and I'm very conscious of this being in New York. I was at Ground Zero yesterday, and one's very conscious of the extent to which those who espouse other religions have sometimes taken those beliefs to extremes, which have caused massive violence and loss of life. But I think the way forward there is for us to do more to understand how other religions work and function, so effecting interreligious dialogue is an important step forward. And of course, that's where Britain and Ireland can do things together as part of the European Union. Europe's role in helping to push against extremism is very important, and we are more powerful together as a European Union than any of us is as an independent state.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to speak with you, and also at this particular time when, there is a recognition that what divided you know, our people for, you know, many centuries has in fact kind of come together and the recognition that, yes, the past has played, a horrific role on today and today's politics, but definitely it would appear that we are moving in the right direction, and that is to give full respect also to politics and to political leanings, and you know, that's not going to go away. This is not what, you know, Christianity, and this is not what religion is about. It plays a role, obviously, and it has historically. But you know, to assume that just going back to the cliche, and to how I know through the decades here, the Americans associated the conflict, particularly in Northern Ireland, as the Catholics fighting the Protestants and the Protestants, and which in fact had. You know, had little to do with the reality of, you know, the political aspects there.
Yes, that's true. But I think what's important and what the President's visit to London has shown is how we can recognise and acknowledge the pain of that past, but that together we can move forwards to a more productive past of mutual cooperation. And that's where I think the Oxford Chair of Celtic, the holder of that role, if we were able to find a visionary donor who were willing to endow it, then that's a position that could play a major role in helping to promote this new opportunity for mutual cooperation, understanding and respect between Britain and Ireland.
Now, there is a North American office. As a matter of fact, it has been in New York, I believe, since... the end of the 1989, wasn't it?
That's right. The University of Oxford has a North American office and based on Fifth Avenue, because there are more alumni of the University of Oxford in the United States than in any other place outside the UK. There are about 20,000 Oxford University alumni in North America, and the North American office is responsible for alumni relations with those people, but also focusing on major gifts to the university, looking for visionary donors who would like to be associated with what is, I think many would recognize, one of the world leading universities.
And to that end, let me give you the website, which is, what is the website? It's, the email is central@oxfordna.org.
Oxfordna.org.
And it's actually located in Manhattan at
500 Fifth Avenue. Yes, it's on Fifth Avenue.
Terrific.
Thank you so much.
Question I want to ask you. Is it coincidental that your conference is taking place, this week at the exact time that that President of Ireland is in London?
I wish I could say that we set it up deliberately to coincide with President Higgins' visit to London, but I'm afraid this is a biennial event that normally happens around this time of year, and it's been a long time in the planning and longer in the planning than the President's visit to London. So it's just one of those coincidences, but it's given me a fantastic opportunity to talk to you, Adrian. I'm very pleased to have done so.
Well, Professor Sarah Fott, again, Chair of the Board of the Faculty of Theology and Religion at Oxford University, University of Oxford. Thank you for joining us. Good luck.
And thank you very much.
We learned a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.